A quantum channel, this is essentially an idealized mathematical model for a noisy quantum process.
Made of this as a completely positive trace-preserving map. And to each channel, you can assign a number, which we call its quantum capacity. And this tells you, roughly, it's the number of qubits which you can protect from the noise of this channel if you're allowed to use the channel many times in succession. And by protect, I mean that you can achieve an arbitrarily low noise, the noise going to zero. And it's measured in units of qubits per use of the channel. And so what I'm going to show is that there exist pairs of channels, each of which are completely useless for the transmission of quantum information. That is, they have a capacity, quantum capacity equal to zero. But nonetheless, if I'm allowed to use them together as a pair, I can actually achieve a non-zero positive quantum capacity. So this is going to be a slightly different type of non-additivity than this very recent preprint by Matt Hastings. But I'll get to that later in the talk, and I'll tell you how it's different. So when did this all start? So this all started with Claude Shannon in 1948. So Shannon defined the capacity of a classical channel for sending classical information. So here a classical channel, I'll use a capital N for this, for noisy process. And I'll think of this as some set of conditional probabilities. And the idea is that I have some finite set of input symbols or signals that I could send, and there's some finite set of output symbols that a receiver could get. And the idea is that you have Alice over here, and you have Bob over here. And we imagine that they're going to use this channel many times in order to try to send information noiselessly. Maybe Alice is here on Earth, and Bob is, you know, a Mars lander or something like that. And so they have a very noisy channel between them, but nonetheless, they can still send information noiselessly. So the idea is that, so we do this by codes, okay? So imagine that you have many instances of the channel here. Let's let there be little n of these. And we'll define what I'll call a rate r block length n error epsilon code. And what this is going to consist of is some sequence or some set of sequences of symbols indexed by some letter m. Let me use capital M. In a set of size 2 to the nr. So n is the block length of the code, r is the rate, and this is how many messages we have. And the idea is that they send these signals, x1 of m down through xn of m, through the channels, and out comes random variables, y1 of m, yn of m. And the idea is that Bob is then going to infer from this his best guess as to what Alice's message was. So let's just imagine that Alice is sending a uniformly random message from this set. So she just picks one at random. And we'll define the error to be the probability that m hat does not equal m, where the message is picked uniformly at random. I could also do this in terms of you know, for each message and have a maximal error constraint. But it's fine for us to just think of this in terms of averages. And we'll say that this is an Rn epsilon code if this probability of error is less than epsilon. So this is what we call an operational definition of the capacity. And so just to make some definitions, we'll say that a rate R is achievable if there exists a sequence of these codes with epsilon going to zero. So that means that this is a rate at which it's possible for them to send information noiselessly, at least in an asymptotic limit. And then we define the capacity of this channel to be the supremum of all the achievable rates R. So this here is what I'll call the operationally defined classical capacity of this classical channel. And so Shannon's big theorem that he proved is that you can easily compute this, that C of n equals the maximum over all probability distributions on the input of a single version of this channel of the mutual information between x and y. So the idea is that this P of x defines a random variable x, and y is correlated with it according to P of y given x. And the mutual information here is just the entropy of x plus plus the entropy of y minus the joint entropy of x and y. So this is Shannon's capacity formula. And this is the thing that basically guides the design of practical real-world error correction. But let me tell you a couple consequences of this formula and properties. So first off, we know that the mutual information is equal to zero if and only if x and y are completely uncorrelated. So what that tells us is that the zero capacity channels are precisely the ones for which x and y are always completely uncorrelated. So there's a zero signal to noise ratio here. But what that means is that if there's any correlation whatsoever, you can send information at some rate. Maybe it's really low, but it's non-zero. So the second thing that we have, and maybe it's not immediately obvious, is that if I have two channels in parallel, right? So what this means is that each time I send, I can send a signal through this channel and through this channel simultaneously. There's not any notion of like making a choice, right? Like you have to send each time. And that this is equal to the sum of the capacities of the individual channels. So what this tells you in some sense is that the capacity is how much you should expect to pay to be able to use that channel, or it's how you would price access to channels. And it really tells you that the capacity is an intrinsic quantity that captures the, you know, it precisely captures the information conveying properties of the channel. And so we say that, so this here, we say that the capacity is additive. And maybe I'll briefly mention that, so this capacity is additive, but let me call this quantity up here C1 of n. So then Shannon's capacity theorem basically says that this operationally defined capacity, which I wrote over here, equals what I'll call C1 of n. So in the way that you show that this is additive is, you know, you show that this quantity, or sorry, that this quantity up here is additive. And in some sense, that's actually what you use to show that this equals that. But so we're not talking about classical channels here. We want to talk about quantum channels. So what's different? So here, a quantum channel. Oh, well, they're the same thing. What I'm saying is I could have called this C1 and then said that this is Shannon's theorem, that this quantity here equals that quantity over there. So you have, in one sense, this easily computable optimization problem. And here you have this potentially horrendous optimization problem, trying to identify, you know, which rates are achievable and which ones aren't. And the beautiful thing is that you can actually compute that. Over two, but sure. So by a quantum channel, I'll use a curly n for quantum noisy. And we'll think of it as a map from density operators on some Hilbert space A to density operators on some Hilbert space B. And completely positive just means that, you know, not only does it map density operators to density operators, but if it acts on part of a density operator, it still produces a density operator. So one way that you can look at a quantum channel is you can imagine it where it's something that takes in a state here, and it's something like this, where there's a hidden unitary inside of it, or an isometry. It takes me out to this Hilbert space here, and there's some environment Hilbert space, right? And the idea is that you can't access that. It's something that's not available to the receiver. And it basically represents all the other degrees of freedom in the rest of the universe that whatever you send through might get entangled with. And the point is that this is a non-unique way to represent a channel, but these are always unique up to isometries on the environment. So it's going to turn out that that extra uniqueness doesn't really impact us in a negative way. So I can define, as I did before, a classical code. And I'll call array r block length n epsilon classical code. But again, I have some set of messages of size 2 to the nr. And what I'll do with these is I'll assign preparations for the inputs of the channels on n instances of the channel. And these will go through the the channels like this, A1, AN, B1, BN. And then now the receiver, Bob, does a measurement that's modeled by a POVM. Right? So these are just positive operators that sum to the identity. And this essentially is analogous to whatever decision rule that Bob might use over here. So here he says, you know, if the received sequence was in some set, I'll say it was message 7. And here he says, well, I make this measurement, and if I got measurement outcome 7, I'll call that I'll declare that to be my message m hat. And then what we can do is we can again define the probability that m hat does not equal m as the error probability, and we'll require that this is less than epsilon again. And then just as we did before with Shannon's original problem, we can define achievable rates as those for which there exist sequences of codes with error going to 0 at a given rate r. And then the capacity, the classical capacity of this channel n, is then going to be the supremum of those achievable rates. So I'll write with a curly c equals the supremum of the achievable rates. And this is the classical capacity. Okay? So let's see. So now we have a theorem. Maybe I'll just write this right here. It's known as the Halevo-Schumacher-Westmoreland theorem, which tells us that that the classical capacity of the channel is given by kind of an ugly looking expression. And that as n goes to infinity of what I'll call C1 of n tensor n, where C1 of n is the maximum over ensembles px, say signal state x on a single instance of the channel, and these are pure states, of the mutual information between x and the resulting state you would get on the output from putting in this pure state on the input. So some people would call this the Halevo-Chi quantity of the ensemble p of x and what you would get on the output. Putting this here. So just a bit on notation. So when I write a ket, I'll mean the pure state. And if I take that same state and I remove the ket, I just mean the projector onto that ket, which would be, you know, the density matrix. Or in general, without a ket, it'll mean a density matrix if it's not one. So what we have here is what people would call a regularized formula for the capacity. So, yeah. And this is kind of an unwieldy thing to deal with, right? You would hope maybe that, that somehow if you could show that this quantity here was added, right, then you could distribute, you could pull an n out in here, and then you would wind up showing that this equals C1. And this was a big open question for a long time. And apparently today on the archive appeared this paper by Matt Hastings, which I guess it hasn't been peer reviewed yet, but I think a lot of us think he's probably right. So theorem Hastings that C1 of n is less than C of n for some channel n. So we do know some examples of classes of channels where this is known to be equal. And I think this holds for what are known as entanglement breaking channels. These are channels that you can't distribute any entanglement over. But it was believed to be true for a long time, and a lot of really smart people gave up a lot of time trying to prove it. So maybe Matt did a great service to the community by freeing up those people's time to work on things that are true and not false.
So, but that in any way, the non-additivity with two different channels in any way implies the result.
He doesn't even show non-additivity directly. Right? He shows minimum output.
Right, which by a result of Shor would imply that. But on the other hand, The channels he uses are the random unitary channels, where in one channel some random unitary is conjugation by, and the other channel is conjugation by the complex conjugates. But I think probably his techniques can be used to just do it for real matrices, and then in which case it'd be the same channel. I mean, the same thing. This was kind of a mirroring of a program that was started by Hayden and started by Winter, continued by Hayden, almost got there, but not quite. But at least for Hayden's results, it was possible to show that that you could restrict to real to make it work. And I'm sure that it'll work in these things. So, yeah, so in some sense here, this, so what Matt showed was that C1 is not additive. And that implies that this can be strictly greater than. But it's a different question, and I would say it's still an open question as to whether or not C of M is additive. And so the result that we have here in regards to the quantum capacity, which I'll take formal definitions for next, is that actually that the quantum capacity itself is not additive. We already know that the analog of this quantity here for the quantum capacity is not additive. But maybe one last comment, which is whenever you have a situation like this in information theory, where you can write something as a regularized formula, so usually, if these two things are different, what you conclude is that we don't have the right formula. So really what this means is that now we don't know what the formula for the classical capacity is in the general problem. And it's now a bigger open question in some sense than it was before. But the situation is worse because now we have no clue what to even guess it might be. So there's more to be done.
John?
But yeah?
Just a clarification question, because this is obviously a tricky point. Is it still open that the classical capacity correctly defined, you know, in the asymptotic way, the regularized way, could in fact be additive?
It's open whether or not it's additive, yes.
Okay, but the quantum capacity is definitely not additive, and that's for Gunnar-Schultz.
Right, okay. So maybe one last thing. So what about zero capacity? Okay, zero classical capacity of the quantum channel, it's the same as with the classical channels. The only zero capacity channels are the ones where there's no correlation between the input and output. And as we'll see for the quantum capacity, that's not necessarily the case. So I guess next I should define the main topic of my talk that we're 20 minutes in. So okay, the quantum capacity, this is a number that captures a variety of different information processing tasks that you might hope to do with a quantum channel. So one thing you might want to do is just to send noiseless information through. In the form of qubits. So say that there's some Hilbert space, I'm going to prepare it in a certain way, encode it into the inputs of many copies of a channel, and then at the end do some recovery operation to get that data out. Another thing you might want to do is to require something slightly stronger, which is to say somebody else hands me some system that's correlated with a bunch of other stuff in their lab, and they say, please send this through the channel and make sure it's recovered well, and that it also maintains whatever correlations it might have had with the stuff in my lab. And that winds up being essentially the same as saying, I want you to simulate for me a noiseless channel at the maximal possible rate. But maybe the easiest one to define, or task that you might want to define, is
just to say, please create maximal entanglement over this channel. So it's a theorem by Barnum, Nil, and Nielsen that essentially all these different tasks lead to the same. They're different definitions of the same quantity. So these all lead us to say, well, the number that I'm going to describe for you next really is something that justifiably can be called the quantum capacity of a quantum channel. And we'll do that again by defining a code. So I'll call a rate r block length n, our epsilon quantum code, and we'll call this entanglement generation is kind of the weakest of all these this family of equivalent tasks that we might hope to do. It'll look like this. So I'll have some Hilbert space M, which is 2 to the nr dimensional. And the idea is that I then prepare some pure state that's on, say, M, and it's on the n inputs to the channels. And so these inputs go like this through the channels. And at the end of the day, Bob does some decoding operation. Here's b1 through bn and a1 through an. And his decoding, this is just another channel or CPTP map, and he's got some output Hilbert space M hat, which is the same dimension as this guy. And what we'll require is that sort of across these terminals that they create the state that's a maximally entangled state between m and m hat. Namely, it's just going to be 1 over square root of 2 to the n r sum over m of m n. And you can show that this is basically the same thing as just having n r EPR pairs between the two. It's unitarily equivalent as long as, as long as r is an integer, I think. But otherwise, it's the floor of that. So you're going to ask that they make the same state. So namely, if I call the state up here, I get, in general, some mixed state, psi hat m, m hat. What I'm going to require is that the fidelity between this state here and the potentially mixed state, or it'll certainly be mixed, be greater than 1 minus epsilon. And if that holds, we'll say that this setup here, that is, this encoding preparation and this decoding operation here, defines a rate r block length and error epsilon entanglement generation code. And again, we play the same game as before. We can define achievable rates as those for which there's a sequence of codes at that given rate with error going to 0. And then the quantum capacity, q of n, is the supremum of all the achievable rates. So this is an operational definition of the quantum capacity. And you can say it one more time that there's all these different tasks that this gives the same number for that you can define without even knowing how to directly characterize this number. So that leads us to say, OK, well, probably this is a well-defined quantity. But what I'll mention next maybe calls that into question in what is still somewhat of a mysterious way. So let's see. So there's a theorem by Lloyd, Shore, and Devitak that the quantum capacity is given by, again, another one of these regularized limits. Which regularized means we have no idea, okay, of Q1 on n copies of the channel, where Q1 of n equals the maximum over density operators on the input of the channel of the entropy induced at the output of the channel by that input minus the entropy induced in the environment by that input. So again, going back to this picture that I drew over here, right? So the idea is that rho A goes in here, and then you induce some output here, and you induce some state on the environment. But as I said before, that this is sort of a non-unique way of representing a channel, non-unique up to isometries on the environment. But isometries don't change the spectrum of a density matrix. So that means that this is still a well-defined quantity, despite whatever representation of the channel we might pick. Okay. So what do we know about this quantity besides? So we don't really not know anything. I mean, we don't know anything in general, I guess. So theorem Shore and Smolin back in 96, they showed that there exist channels such that this holds. There's a strict inequality. And moreover, this is precisely 0. So again, this is just the single letter. They call this the coherent information. So this is the single letter coherent information. And actually, it's a fairly simple channel. It's just a depolarizing channel with depolarizing probability strong enough such that the environment always has essentially the same entropy as the output, or at least as much. Okay? So in some sense, this here is the analog of this for classical capacities is what Hastings just proved today. But why is it harder? Well, it's harder because here you've got channels which have single letter coherent information equal to 0, but they still have some correlations between the input and the output. Whereas for classical capacity, So this quantity right here, the Halévy-Okai or the mutual information, is only 0 when the channel has no correlations whatsoever. So in some sense, it was a lot harder to find a channel for, well, I should also say when you tensor such channels together, they still have no correlations. So you couldn't play one of these 0 you know, these gains where something is zero with the classical case, as you were, as these guys were able to do then. But I should also mention that the violation here, very small. Yes.
I mean, this is sort of, this has an operation, the regularized thing has an operational interpretation, right, the CN.
Right.
If I look in the regularized limit, the n goes to infinity limit, does h of b minus h of v have an operational interpretation? Can I understand why this lets me send entanglement at this rate?
Yeah, roughly, I mean, it's, you can kind of think of this h of e as being a penalty that you pay to get rid of correlations with the environment. So one way to prove this theorem here is to show that if I pick a random subspace of dimension, just this here, and when you show that you can achieve these with codes, you really just focus on this single letter quantum here. And then all the rest is just packaging to show that the ultimate thing is this limit. Because you can show that if you can achieve this, then you can achieve this for any n. So, and the way that you do that is you say, well, let's just pick something that maximizes this. And then let's pick a random subspace of a carefully selected subspace of the input that has this exponent. Okay, and then you can show with high probability that random subspace will be completely decoupled from the environment. And so maybe I should, shameless self-promotion, there's a, so we have a proof of this. Me, Hayden, Winter, and Horodetsky. And it's in this, there's a special issue of the, what's it called? It's the information system, like open systems and information dynamics or something that's just devoted to the quantum capacity. And it has about four different proofs in it. But I think ours is the simplest, but that's just, maybe I'm biased. So that is one proof that's a lot easier to understand than say this one here is the first fully rigorous proof was Devitt's. So what's our theorem? So theorem Smith Yard 08 says that there exist channels N1 and N2 such that the quantum capacity, no longer just one, of N1, tensor N2, is strictly greater than the quantum capacity of N1 plus the quantum capacity of N2 equals zero. So, and of course, these can never be negative, so that means that they're both equal to zero. So, i.e., there exist channels which are completely useless for sending quantum information, despite however many times you want to use N1 or N2. Yet somehow, when you bring them together, you can use them for sending information. So just to drive that home, let me draw a picture. So imagine that I tried to do this entanglement generation in two steps. Did it with psi 1, or epsilon 1, epsilon 2. They have two Hilbert spaces here. And I send these guys through many copies of the channel, N1. N2, and then Bob does a decoder here, and then Bob does some decoder here, and he tries to create something, you know, two maximally entangled states. This will never work. That you can never get really any entanglement across these channels, not even a linear number of e-bits of entanglement. But on the other hand, if we did sort of a joint coding like this, which was going into all the channels at once, and then just a single decoder on the output like this, and just one system here, then it is possible. So why should this disturb you? So number one, what it says is that in some sense, this number, Q, the quantum capacity of the channel, does not completely capture the information transmitting properties of the channel. So I mean, what does that even mean? So I told this to a friend of mine, my old roommate, who is not a physicist. And he said, So if the quantum capacity doesn't completely capture the information conveying properties of the channel, why do you want to compute it? So I actually didn't immediately have an answer for him. But I mean, why do you want to compute it? Because we want to know how well we can error correct, right? We want to understand how to build a quantum computer. But I think what it doesn't necessarily tell us there's something wrong with the quantum capacity, but it just tells us that it's part of a larger picture that is yet to be discovered. And so there are sort of some nice, okay, let me just say a little more before I go there.
I mean, there is difference both at the encoding and at the decoding between the two settings. So the power comes from letting the encoding be different, the decoding both?
I think it's both.
Okay.
I've kind of wondered that myself, really. Is it could be one or the other? But ideally, I think it's both. I think you would have to encode into two separate ones, and then I'd be very surprised if the separate decoders could do it. But I think it's a good question. I don't really know the answer.
Would it be more
likely
to be the other way?
What's that?
I mean, you might be able, if anything, you might be able to do it with separate encoding but joint decoding.
Maybe. I really don't know. So so what about zero capacity? So what's different here, okay? So here we have these two channels that have zero capacity. And I said for classical, it's sort of trivial when you have zero capacity. But when do you get zero capacity in the quantum case? So the answer is we don't really entirely know yet. So we don't have a complete characterization of zero capacity channels. So these are the types of noise which you can never hope to protect quantum information from. It's a good thing that we should try to characterize. But what do we know? So here's, I'll give you a non-inclusive list of some cases where we know that you have zero capacity. One, what I'll call symmetric channels. And these are channels whose isometric extensions, that's this picture I drew inside the cloud there, map you into the symmetric subspace of B and E. So imagine that B is the output, E is this environment, and you can choose it to have the same dimension as the output, and that there's some correspondence between their degrees of freedom, so I can talk about symmetrizing. And if A maps into the symmetric subspace, what does this mean? This means that no matter what state I put in, Bob is going to get the same state as Eve, the eavesdropper or environment person, and vice versa. So that means that Q1 is going to equal 0 because H of B equals H of B. And you can also show that this class of channels is stable under tensor products. So if I had two such channels and I tensor them, I get another such channel. And you can use that to conclude that Q is 0. Or sort of a nice operational way of looking at this is assume Q is positive. Well, then if I could send at some positive rate to Bob, then somebody who's watching the environment of this channel could also do the same thing Bob did. And they could also decode whatever stuff I sent, and I would be cloning information. So this is forbidden by the no cloning theorem, if you want a different non-algebraic way to see it. So the second class of channels, or another class of channels, is what I'm going to call in this talk Horodetsky channels, because these were discovered by the Horodetsky family, or at least in the context of stealing quantum information from bipartite states. And these are also known as PPT, positive partial transpose, or entanglement finding channels. And so these are channels that can only create joint states of the form, say, rho AB equals acting on some state. So imagine Alice has some bipartite state in her lab, and she acts on half of it with the channel, turns it into a state on AB. And it can only create such states that remain positive under a partial transposition. So what's a partial transpose? Well, we know what it means to make the transpose of a matrix, right? So this just says let the transpose act only on, say, the B system. Or in other words, if I write rho AB in the form, I don't know, IJ, IJ, tensor rho IJ, right? And the partial transpose just transposes the guys in each block. And it's known that entangled states, let's see, what is known exactly? Well, it's certainly known that if I have a maximally entangled state, and I take the partial transpose, it's going to go negative. But I guess what's known is, yeah, so that's enough for us here. And so it turns out that if you have a channel that can only create these states, and bell pairs are NPT, they have a negative partial transpose, then you can never use any channels like that to create information or to transfer quantum information. Maybe I should also add that any post-processing, you know, if I act on one half of this guy and I communicate to the other half and they do stuff, I could never turn a PPT state into an NPT state. So for entirely different reasons than with these symmetric channels, these hard entity channels also have zero quantum capacity. And so what we're going to do is, well, may I add one more thing? So if I take any collection of hard Hardetsky channels and I put them together, they're going to have zero capacity. If I take any collection of symmetric channels, they'll also have zero capacity when I use them together. But what we're going to do is we're going to take a channel from each class. And if this is done carefully, you can actually get a channel that has non-zero capacity. So Charlie Bennett he likened this to saying that it's almost like channels have two sexes. We have male channels and we have female channels. You can use as many males together as you want and they could never have children. And the same with the females. Well, let's just say you can. And but if you carefully select them so that the channels, you know, hit it off, then they can have a family. And this was Charlie's way of putting it. So there's a guy who wrote an article about this in the IEEE Spectrum magazine. And he put it in a little more G-rated way. He said it's like quantum information was green water or something, okay? And it's like you have pipes that can only transmit, say yellow water, and you have pipes that can only transmit blue water. So if you use these pipes together, there's some magical way in which you can split the quantum information into different types or something and send them through. So you think of it however you want. But the point is that you can't really just take any channels from either class, right? So in some sense, most Hardetsky channels are sterile. And some of them have the ability to be used for quantum transmission. And these are the ones that can at least be used to send private information. So for that, I need to define one more capacity of a channel, which we'll call the private capacity of a channel. And this is, you know, has ties in with classical cryptography and how you might send private data over a channel. Where? Okay, well, I'm going to erase something, though, because I don't want to redraw something. I'm trying to remember where I drew it. So it was up here. Oh, here's my erase. So what about the private capacity? The private classical capacity of a quantum channel, we're going to add in some extra constraint. Namely, in this picture here, we get really paranoid, and we assume that there's an eavesdropper who could access any of the environments of any of the channels that we're using. And we want to try to make codes such that even the best eavesdropper has no hope of guessing what we were going to say over the channel. So for that, we can define private codes to be done in the same way as we did here with these plain old classical codes. And we change two things. First of all, we allow mixed state encodings. So I'll erase this K. And it turns out that you need to do that, because you kind of need to introduce some randomization at the encoder. And the second thing is that we add in a constraint such that, so all the possible states that come out in the environment, so I'll say psi m en, they should all be nearby each other, m prime en. So by this, I just mean the state that's created from putting in this state here. So these guys in trace norm.
should all be less than epsilon away from each other. So if that's the case, you could show, essentially by using the Halevo bound, but there's other ways of showing it too, that the eavesdropper is not going to get very much information out. And even more so, you can make this epsilon go down exponentially fast with n. It's also possible, which really means that like you can actually make it go down super exponentially. So they really don't even get like a bit out, and it doesn't change the rate. So with that condition added, we can define the private capacity of a channel to be done in the same way that we did with all these other ones, where you define achievable rates and blah, blah, blah. And then you get this P of n equals, so this is a theorem by Devatak. It's actually how he originally, it was a step towards his original proof of the quantum coding theorem, this LSD theorem. So here you have, this is a regularization of what we might call the private information, which is going to be given by the maximization over now mixed state ensembles occurring with P of X and the state X here of what's now going to be a difference of mutual informations. So here you have the mutual information between X and the output minus the mutual information between X and the environment or eavesdropper system. So in some sense, this second mutual information is like a price that you pay by having to make sure that what you send is decorrelated from what the environment gets. And essentially, even the way this is proved is you start with codes that achieve the classical capacity, then you kind of throw them into bins that are, you know, that grow at this rate, so that the number of bins you have has a rate of growth given by this quantity here. What's that? Oh, yeah. What's that? Tensorine, yes. Sorry, you get sloppy. Okay. So this is the private capacity of the channel. And so let's see. Now, so there's a third board. Do I need this stuff? So, let's see. How much time do I have? Good. Right. So there's a theorem by Penkovsky and a number of Horodetskys. I think it's three of them. I'm not really sure. So let's see. And what does this theorem say? So it says that private Horodetsky channels exist. So in other words, there exist channels that have Q of n equal to zero. And what they actually show is that this P1 of n is greater than zero. So all known private Horodetsky channels, actually, they're showing that this single letter private information is positive. I don't think we know of any examples of private Horodetsky channels with P1 of n equal to zero, but with, say, P1 of n tensor n positive. Oh, yeah, you're right. I reversed the order. Yes. This is Oppenheim. And then, so the next one is Penkovsky and Oppenheim, where they said that, so there exists a channel N on two qubits. Right. I'm going to use this one later. I confused them. Such that the same stuff holds. And actually, so what they show there, I can actually give a little more, is that so with respect to the uniform ensemble of states, zero, tensor, maxly mixed, and one, tensor, maxly mixed, that they get I of x, p, minus I of X E is greater than 0.02, just to give you a real number to think about. And so it's a fairly low dimensional example. And really they construct, you know, this original paper constructs whole classes of channels, and it's really kind of a pain to understand because it's sort of hard to show that the partial transpose is positive. But what they do in this paper here, which is nice, is they actually work with PPT invariant states. So there it's easy to show. If once it's invariant, you know that its partial transpose is positive. And so this, I'm not going to tell you this example because I'm not sure it would be that enlightening in this talk, and you can read about it. But I want to talk about how do we leverage this into a proof of non-additivity of the quantum capacity. So we do something slightly different in the main text of our paper, but there's a slightly easier, at least to present without me defining another capacity, way to see it that's done in the appendix or in the supporting online material if you want to read about it. So what we show is that, so given some ensemble of states, px, and so rho x, and given some channel that goes from A to B with environment E, okay, let E, curly E, be a 50% erasure channel. So I didn't mention this earlier, but this is an example of a symmetric channel. So this is a type of channel that has, say, a d-dimensional input, a d plus one dimensional output. And what it does is half the time it delivers the input state to the receiver, Bob. And it also tells him that, yes, you got the state. And the other half of the time it gives that state to the environment. And the environment also knows whether or not it got the state. So this channel actually winds up being symmetric. When it's at 50%, they both get the same state. And so this channel is going to turn out it's actually sufficient for us to generate a counterexample, assuming that the input is sufficiently large. So let's let the with input dimension equal to the sum over x of the rank of rho xA. Okay, so just the sum of the ranks of these guys in the signal ensemble. And so then what we have is that this Q1, this single letter coherent information of the channel, the original channel, this will be a private Horodesky channel, we'll take it to be one, but this holds regardless, is greater than or equal to 1/2 of the mutual information between X and B minus that between X and E. So it's actually not really hard to prove this, but I don't want to give the proof now. I mean, you can read about it, but I'll just say a little bit about why this winds up being true or how the proof goes. So the idea is that you start off with this mixed state ensemble, right, which you can kind of think of as one of the ensembles that you use in order to achieve privacy, right? So instead of pure state ensembles, you have mixed state. And the idea is that what you can do is you can take the purifications of each one of these states, right? And if the input to the erasure channel is the sum of the ranks of these guys, then what I can do is I can purify these guys into the input of the erasure channel in such a way that all the purifications are orthogonal. So in other words, somebody measuring the input of the erasure channel can distinguish which state in the ensemble that I have here. And that winds up being important in the proof. And so it turns out that you can write the coherent information in this way. So I have this formula here for the private information, right? If I replace these with pure states, that actually gives you the coherent information. And it's basically because in that case, I mean, you can just write it out. This is like an entropy minus a conditional entropy, and this is an entropy minus a conditional entropy. But those conditional entropies come from halves of pure states. So then they're equal. And then you wind up getting H of B minus H of E. But this is a 50% erasure channel, so only half the time is Bob getting what he wants. So that's where this factor of a half comes from. Okay. So basically this is, so then we're done, right? Because if there exist channels that are private channels, these private Horodetsky channels, that satisfy something like this. So for instance, if we take this four-dimensional channel here, and then if I plug in an erasure channel here of dimension 4, and why dimension 4? Because I have two states in the ensemble, and each one is rank 2, so the sum of these ranks is 4. So I now have two four-dimensional channels, each of which has a zero quantum capacity, but when I use them together, they have a quantum capacity greater than 0.01. So okay, you say, big deal, 0.01, right? But I should mention that these earlier counterexamples that we had for the additivity of, say, the coherent information, these were, I mean, we're talking like 0.000 something. I mean, I don't know, really small. But really, you can kind of leverage this into a much bigger counterexample for the non-additivity of the coherent information. And I'll just mention that, and then I think I'm basically done. But oh, maybe I don't need to do this. Is there another board? Yeah. So here's what we'll do. So we'll use these two channels, this N and this E, which are going to be acting on two qubits, right? And these come from this Pankowski-Horodetsky channel. And I'll define a new channel, M, that acts on three qubits, okay? And what this channel does is it measures the first qubit in a 0-1 basis. And if it was 0, it applies the channel N to the second two qubits. And if it's 1, it applies the erasure channel to the second two qubits. So it's straightforward to show that using this channel, let's call this M1 for reasons you'll see, this channel satisfies Q1 of M equals 0. Because it's either one of the zero capacity channels or the other one, right? But now, imagine that I use the channel twice. Yep. No. The channel does a measurement, and then the environment is pure. You know, the measurement is purified into the environment. So, you know, I'm really doing just like a half on this if we want. But so now imagine if I use this channel twice, okay? So Alice can control which channel gets applied to the second two qubits, right? So this is at least as big as, well, let me get rid of this, as Q1 of just N tensor the erasure channel, because she can cause it to look like this channel. I mean, maybe there's something else sneaky she can do, but we don't think about that. And so we know this guy here is greater than 0.01. So, and we also know that this here gives a lower bound to the quantum capacity of M, okay? So now we have a channel which has a zero capacity, but whose quantum capacity is greater than 0.01. So I'll also say that this is a much bigger violation than we had before for the coherent information. But now you might say, so what? It's just 0.01, right? But so here's what we can do. Let me define a channel MK to act on k plus 1 qubits. Maybe you can see where this is going. The idea is that, or sorry, 2k plus 1 qubits. And the idea is that the channel measures the first qubit in the 0-1 basis. And if it's 0, it applies n tensor k to the first, you know, to the rest of the 2k qubits. And if it's 1, it applies e tensor k to the rest of the qubits. So then what you wind up getting by the same line of reasoning is that Q of M is greater than 0.01 times K for any K. So what it means is that you can have an arbitrarily large violation. And also, of course, you have that Q1 of MK is still equal to 0. So what it means is that this coherent information, which has in some sense been kind of the major benchmark against which to measure the performance of quantum error correction. I should have mentioned it's also called the hashing bound, which everybody talks about the hashing bound. And almost always they really mean the hashing bound applied to just a maximally mixed input. So they're not even optimizing over pure states. But it means that this is a terrible way to judge how well you're correcting errors. And and so something else that we can prove by similar means is that so I should mention that among all these quantities that I've defined here, right? If we think about the classical capacity of a classical channel, turns out that that's a convex function of the channel, okay? And also this Q1, this coherent information, is a convex function of the channel. And it was an open question for a long time whether or not Q, the regularized capacity, was a convex function of the channel. And actually, the night before we proved this, I was trying to prove that Q was a convex function of the channel. And I failed, and that's because it's not. And it follows from this. But so I guess I'll stop there. Thanks.
You said you can have a violation by lot, but you're doing that by increasing the dimension, right?
Sure, sure.
So, I mean, it seems, and since, you know, if you had, like, a perfect channel, you sent data through that, then you'd also be increasing the capacity. So maybe it makes more sense
to... a perfect channel? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what the right comparison is to say, because it seems to me that as you get to channels on more qubits,
right,
all the numbers get larger. Right?
Maybe.
Well, if you measure, no, I mean,
I see what you mean, and sure, it would be nicer to find bigger violations on smaller dimensional inputs or something, but a lot of people believed that maybe somehow the coherent information was essentially the capacity, and that it was, you know, up to, like, tiny corrections or something.
Well, but it still could be up to tiny corrections as a fraction of the number of qubits.
Maybe,
like that.
Yeah.
I think at least it's linear. In the number of qubits, in that sense, like,
sure,
it's not sublinear or anything, but you cannot expect it to be more than linear. Yeah.
Right.
So it's all in the constant.
Well, I mean, in some sense, you can't expect it to be more than linear. But the question, but that's not the issue. I mean, the issue is that so suppose it is linear. So, and obviously the ratio is infinite. The ratio is infinite from 0.01 to zero. So that's fine, but for small k, it can be more than linear. But
there's a max on the capacity. Linear,
yeah. For small k, it can be more than linear because 0.01 gives you a lot of room to get up to one. But I don't really know what I'm going for here. But I mean.
But I mean,
but also
0.01 is just the simplest example we know, right? I mean,
sure.
There aren't many examples of these channels going. Presumably, you could get a lot bigger than that of a single copy. But also keep in mind that, like, capacity of, say, this channel MK is still essentially bounded by 2K or something like that. So it's only growing linearly. And here you have some other quantity here that's growing linearly as well. So.
Yeah, so I'm saying that you should compare those two to say whether one is big or not, and not just, you know, compare 0.01k with 1, because 1 is kind of a meaningless number here.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe it's not so bad, but I mean,
it's
really hard to make any sort of arguments about what goes on with these things, because you're trying to argue about exponentially large optimization problems, so sort of why we don't know even what the optimal Q1 is of, say, n tensor 5, right, if it's recurrent, like, it's just too hard to do.
I mean, just to defend, like, I basically agree with you, but to defend that perspective, you might have expected that even if the coherent information wasn't a bound, that it might be off by at most, you know, 1 over pi cubed, period, for all channels. I mean, I'm picking a small number. And the fact that it does scale with the size of the channel, I think, is significant.
Well, okay. I mean, maybe a little bit. I don't find it all that significant. I mean, I'm not completely sure it makes sense to say that, you know, there's only a small violation of additivity.
Sorry.
Since you're comparing zero to...
I mean, any scaling will have to be linear, right? You could even have a quadratic difference because.
Well, again, for small k, so.
For small k storage.
That's what I'm saying. Is that finding a violation that's linear that doesn't mean anything to me? Because again, that's kind of what you'd expect. So, it's just.
That's a good point. That is a good point. But I also don't know what else you would hope to find from this linear.
I have no objection to linear scaling. It's just that if it makes sense at all to say that there's a small violation, you have to scale it somehow with the size of the channel. And the linear is the obvious way to do that.
But why is that obvious? Why not constant? Why not sublinear?
Well, that, I mean, so that
other,
could have
other
been
than
true.
The example, right?
That could have been true. And if true, that would have been interesting. But that would have been surprising to me.
That's what I'm, why, though? What's the intuition that made you say, if there was
a
violation?
Because if you have a channel where, you know, if you can get even one two-dit through, that dit can send a billion qubits of information, why would you expect the violations to be so incredibly small that it's only a small fraction of a qubit, right, when one full register is so much information? Mm-hmm. Right? You should expect the violations to increase as the size of the system increases.
So you're talking about the difference between Q1 versus Q2 divided by 2 versus Q...
No, I guess it's really the difference between Q and Q1.
Q1 and K versus...
Q minus Q1. Q1. But why look at Q minus Q1 rather than Q minus Q1 over log dimension?
We have time for one more quick question. Okay, if not, let's thank John again.
Thank you.